two poets who were very pleased to be presenting tonight, along with some music of Latin America. The program tonight will have a decidedly Latino flavor to it, so I hope that you've got your ears open and minds ready to be expanded. The sequence of events will be our guest poet from Boston, Martin Espada, will begin the evening. And after his reading, we'll take a short break where you can just relax and move around if you wish to get something to drink. Perhaps can take a look at the books that are available for sale in the River Styx magazines and buy any if you wish to. And then we'll come back with a little bit of music, and then Peter Carlos will read. So we're going to get right to it now and bring Martin Espada up here. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. Whoever in the future wishes to find the truth about our age will have to read poets like Martin Espada. He brings to American poetry an imagination and a sense of history which it has not previously known. The shared experience of Latin American immigrants and workers is his subject. This is political poetry at its best. These are poems about hard work and poverty and discrimination. He is the poet of that knowledge, the full weight of that knowledge. The greatness of Espada's art, like all great art, is that it gives dignity to the insulted and the injured of the earth. This was a statement that was made by three very eminent poets, Carolyn Forché, Daniel Halpern, and Charles Simic, who were unanimous in their praise for Martin Espada's most recent book, Rebellion is the Circle of a Lover's Hands. This book received the Penn Revson Foundation Fellowship for Poetry Award in 1989 and is just out in the past month. Martin Espada was born in Brooklyn, New York, of Puerto Rican parents, and is a practicing tenant lawyer. He is the author of two previous books of poems, The Immigrant's Ice Boy Bolero, which came out in 1982, and Trumpets from the Islands of Their Eviction, which is also available at our book table, which was published in 1987. He's received many grants and awards, including awards from the Massachusetts Artists Foundation and Creative Writing Fellowship, from the National Endowment for the Arts. And he's published in the anthology of the best younger poets in the United States called Under 35. He's published widely in magazines, including River Styx. We're happy that we were among the first magazines to recognize the quality of his work and to publish him, and we're very happy to say that he still publishes with us. And what you should know that hasn't been said, and I think you probably got from hearing between the lines, is that his poetry is people-oriented. I think you'll find it very direct and not necessitating that you have 5 years of English Department graduate school for you to hear it. So you just have to be open to it and let it connect, because I'm sure with that openness it will connect. The poetry, although it deals largely with the experience of Latino Americans, has a very universal quality to it. Martin, as the comments I just made indicated, works every day with poor people as a tenant lawyer and is actually a documentarian in many of his poems. You may be reading about him tomorrow morning in the Post-Dispatch. Look for his picture because he was interviewed as a victim of the sudden closing of the Forest Park Hotel for non-payment of taxes. So he's had a strange trip, and welcome to St. Louis, and he might tell you a little bit more about it. But I think he's beginning to feel at home here. He's been here the last couple of days and has kind of been moving around. I'll read just another little clip from the introduction to this book, The Rebellion is the Circle of a Lover's Hands. That was written, the introduction was written by Amiri Baraka. Some of you I know were at the reading that Amiri Baraka did for River Styx just about a month ago. Baraka says, most of the poems in this book are crafted with one of the most meticulous eyes and ears to hear. If it ain't sound, it ain't even hear. To the created, breathing life of contemporary of American poetry, I've seen de nuevo. And he opens this introduction by saying, Martin got the stick. That could be this volume's title. It's that clear, like we screaming at the big relay race. What that guy's name who just got the stick? Espada, some hip colleague will tell us. Martin Espada. He's getting up, ain't he? Martin Espada.
Thank you. Okay, can people hear me okay? All right. Thank you, Michael, for that introduction. Yes, it is true that tomorrow morning you will see in the newspaper a photograph of two befuddled tourist types wondering how it was that their hotel was seized for non-payment of taxes. We've had some adventures in St. Louis since we got here on Saturday. Yeah. Also, just I want to issue a public warning. There is this Christmas show down the street called Christmas World of Wonder. Please avoid it. It is indeed a tourist trap of the lowest order. And it's okay if they decide to sue me because I'm a lawyer. Okay. I want to thank Michael not only for his introduction, but for even thinking to call me up and to bring me all the way from Boston. And I wonder how many people are aware of just how good a magazine Michael runs. Being from the East Coast, I can tell you that not only is it, I think, perhaps the best damn literary magazine in the country, but it's now a magazine which other magazines are doing their best to imitate. And so all of those staid, conservative New England literary journals like Plowshares and On Your Review and so on are now suddenly publishing multicultural literature that Michael and his friends have been publishing for 15 years. So I just want to point that out, that our perspective from the East is that this is an extraordinary magazine. And I hope you know how lucky you are that it's here in St. Louis. And indeed, there are copies of it available. I hope you spend a few dollars to pick some of them up. It really is a magazine that's been on the cutting edge of literature, particularly multicultural literature in this country, for a long, long time. Anyway, that's my commercial for River Styx. And actually, I'm going to begin with a poem that was published by River Styx. It's a poem which is based on a story I heard circulating in the migrant labor camps in Maryland, where I was doing legal work in 1983. The poem is called Federico's Ghost. The story is that whole families of fruit pickers still crept between the furrows of the field at dusk, when, for reasons of whiskey or whatever, the crop duster plane sprayed anyway, floating a pesticide drizzle over the pickers who thrashed like dark birds in a glistening white net. Except for Federico, a skinny boy who stood apart in his own green row, and, knowing the pilot would not understand in Spanish that he was the son of a whore, instead jerked his arm and thrust an obscene finger. The pilot understood. He circled the plane and sprayed again, watching a fine gauze of poison drift over the brown bodies that cowered and scurried on the ground, and aiming for Federico, leaving the skin beneath his shirt wet and blistered, but still pumping his finger at the sky. After Federico died, rumors at the labor camp told of tomatoes picked and smashed at night, growers muttering of vandal children or communists in camp, first threatening to call immigration, then promising every Sunday off if only the smashing of tomatoes would stop. Still, tomatoes were picked and squashed in the dark, and the old women in camp said it was Federico, laboring after sundown to cool the burns on his arms, flinging tomatoes at the crop duster that hummed like a mosquito lost in his ear and kept his soul awake. Thank you. Anybody let me know if they can't hear, because I see you're scattered to the four winds. And it's a great turnout. It's terrific. I think it was mentioned in the introduction, my family is from Puerto Rico. And one of the things I have been doing is working on a series of historical poems about the island. And trying to do something which I call putting a human face on history, taking it away from the abstract and making it as direct and clear and concrete as possible. You're going to hear an awful lot about Puerto Rico coming in the next couple of years, especially in 1992 when they celebrate Columbus. And they do a lot of things like, well, I just did a reading in Philadelphia called, what do they call it, Puerto Rico Discovery Day. Which was actually, I said, well, this is Conquest Day, you mean. And there's going to be that dialogue going on in 1992, especially, the 500th anniversary of Columbus. And so we are always trying to recover and redefine our own history, because being a colony of the United States, one of the things that happens is we lose our history. It's taken away from us, and people here certainly do not get the chance to hear about the history of Puerto Rico. One such historical incident took place in the coastal town of Ponce on Palm Sunday, 1937. Pro-independence activists were massacred in the streets of Ponce at the orders of the governor of the island, whose name was, good old Spanish name, Blanton Winship. He was a Southern general appointed by President Roosevelt, not elected. We didn't get a chance to elect our own governor until after World War II. This was something that actually caused a lot of a stir here in this country. There were campus protests, ACLU issued a report, and then it was forgotten. It became a historical footnote. And then one day, a friend of mine told me the following story about his mother and her fiancé and what happened to them as a result of this Ponce massacre. So the poem, which is the title poem of the new book, is Rebellion is the Circle of a Lover's Hands, Beijing and Nina. And it was written for the 50th anniversary of the Ponce Massacre. The marchers gathered. Nationalists massed beneath the delicate white balconies of Marina Street. And the colonial governor pronounced the order with patrician calm. 50 years of family history says it was Beijing who dipped a finger into the bloody soup of his own body and scratched defiance in jagged, wet letters on the sidewalk. Around him stormed the frenzied, clattering drum beat of machine guns, the stampede of terrified limbs, and the panicked wail that rushed babbling past his dim senses. Palm Sunday, 1937. The news halted the circular motion of his lover's hands as she embroidered the wedding dress. She nodded, knew before she was told. Years later, with another family in a country of freezing spring rain called Nueva York, Nina is quietly nervous when her son speaks of rifles in a bullhorn shout, when coffins are again bobbing on the furious swell of hands and shoulders, and the whip of nightsticks brings fresh blood stinging from the scalp. But rebellion is the circle of a lover's hands that must keep moving, always weaving. Thanks. A few years ago, my father and I went back to the town where he was born, Utuado, way up in the mountains of Puerto Rico. I myself am from the mountains of Brooklyn. The projects. So this was an adventure, the two of us going back to Utuado, where he was born. And while we were there, we suddenly decided we were going to look for the grave of my great-grandfather, whose name was Buenaventura Roig. Buenaventura, by the way, in Spanish, is a name which translates to good luck or good fortune. So it's a remarkable name for a larger-than-life figure, and every family has at least one in their history. And we began searching for the grave, and this poem actually came out of all that. There are a few words in Spanish. First of all, the poem is called La Tumba de Buenaventura Roig. Tumba is simply a cognate for grave. And then in the body of the poem, I make reference to flamboyán, which is a red flowering tree in Puerto Rico. Patrones, of course, were the big landowners. And the jíbaro is our word for peasant. You may have heard the Spanish word campesino for peasant. We say jíbaro. And then finally, I make reference to San Miguel, or St. Michael, who's the patron saint of Utuado. So the poem again is called La Tumba de Buenaventura Roig, for my great-grandfather, who died in 1941. Buenaventura Roig. Once peasants in the thousands streamed down hillsides to witness the great eclipse of your funeral. Now your bones have drifted with the tide of steep grass, sunken in the chaos of weeds, bent and suffering like cane cutters in the sun. The drunken caretaker cannot find the grave, squinting at your name, spitting as he stumbles between the white Christs, with hands raised, sowing their field of white crosses. Buenaventura Roig. In Utuado, you built the stone bridge crushed years later by a river raving like a forgotten god. Here, sweat streaked your face with the soil of coffee, the ground where your nephew slept while rain ruined the family crop, and his blood flowered like flamboyán on the white suit of his suicide. Buenaventura Roig, in the town plaza where you were mayor, where there once was a bench with the family name, you shouted subversion against occupation armies and sugarcane patrones to the jíbaros who swayed in their bristling dry thicket of straw hats, who knew bundles and sacks loaded on the fly-bitten beast of a man's back. Buenaventura Roig, not enough money for a white Christ. Lost now, even to the oldest gravedigger, the one with an English name descended from the pirates of the coast, who grabs for a shirt pocket cigarette as he remembers your funeral, a caravan trailing in the distance of the many years that crack the skin around his eyes. Buenaventura Roig, We are small among mountains. And we listen for your voice in the peasant chorus of five centuries, waiting for the cloudburst of wild sacred song, pouring over the crypt wreckage of graveyard, over the plaza and the church, where the statue of San Miguel still chokes the devil with a chain. I used to write a lot of poems like that, what I would call poetry of advocacy, poetry which speaks for someone who does not have the opportunity to speak for him or herself, not that they couldn't if they had the chance, but poetry of advocacy. And then one day someone said to me, you know, you coward, why don't you ever write about yourself? So I said, all right, you know. And the first few poems were very melodramatic. You know, I was the hero and everybody else was the villain. And eventually I got around that. And some poems like this next one started to come about. This poem, in a way, is about metamorphosis, because all of us have been many different people during the course of one lifetime. And the person you see before you is not the person I was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I was, believe it or not, 50 pounds lighter. And I was hungry. And I ended up being referred to a food pantry for free food, St. Vincent de Paul. If people here in St. Louis have St. Vinny's, yeah. You know, it's kind of like the Salvation Army, only less subtle, you know. So anyway, there I was waiting for my food, and the following happened. The St. Vincent de Paul food pantry stomp in the sense of a dance. Madison, Wisconsin, 1980. Waiting for the carton of food, given with Christian suspicion, even to agency-certified charity cases like me, thin and brittle as uncooked linguine, anticipating the factory-damaged cans of tomato soup, beets, three-bean salad in a welfare cornucopia, I spotted a squashed dollar bill on the floor and, with a St. Vincent de Paul food pantry stomp, pinned it under my sneaker, tied my laces meticulously, and stuffed the bill in my sock like a smuggler of diamonds, all beneath the plaster statue wingspan of St. Vinny, who was unaware of the dance named in his honor by a maraca shaker in the salsa band of the unemployed. Actually, I dedicate that poem to all of the unemployed workers at the hotel that got closed down this morning. Another poem going further back in time, actually back to high school. When I say that, that often produces hisses from the audience. So. This poem requires a little bit of introduction. The best way I can introduce this poem is to say that, in a sense, we Puerto Ricans are the original Rainbow Coalition. We are a combination of three races blending together over a period of 500 years. Of course, the Taino Indians who originally inhabited the island, the Africans who were brought as slaves, and the Spanish conquerors, 500 years blending together to produce something else. And a multicultural, multiracial society is really what it is. Then we come to this country, so polarized. And very often what happens is we, too, end up playing the skin game. We, too, end up playing that game of who's the darkest one in the family and how do you hide it? And there are a couple of people I refer to in this poem who that happened to, including my own father. And yet the poem takes off from something else. The poem takes off from that racism which comes from without and goes along with the racism from within our own community. And that racism from without was represented here by my high school nickname, which was, by the way, Nigger Lips. Nigger Lips was the high school name for me. so-called by Douglas the car mechanic, with green tattoos on each forearm, and the choir of round pink faces that grinned deliciously from the back row of classrooms, droned over by teachers checking attendance too slowly. Douglas would brag about cruising his car near sidewalks of black children to point an unloaded gun. "To scare niggers like crows off a tree," he'd say. My great-grandfather Luis was un negrito, too, a shoemaker in the Coffee Hills of Puerto Rico, 1900. The family called him a secret and kept no photograph. My father remembers the childhood white powder that failed to bleach his stubborn copper skin, and the family says he is still a fly in milk. So, Nigger Lips has the mouth of his great-grandfather, the song he must have sung as he pounded the leather and nails, the heat that courses through copper, the stubbornness of a fly in milk, and all you have, Douglas, is that unloaded gun. Thanks. That, by the way, illustrates one of the advantages of being a poet. Revenge. I was wondering what would happen if I ever ran into that guy. Yeah. Probably wouldn't read him poetry, though. One of the other things that poem is about is the power of naming. Who gets to name you and your experience? Do you get to do it, or does somebody else do it? And that is a power indeed. This next poem also has to do with that, although in a very different way. Poem actually literally has to do with my name. I'm not referring to my first name, which, since it looks like Martin, can be said that way, and that's okay. But I refer to my last name, which is Espada, which, you know, E-S-P-A-D-A. You know, it's even, you know, follow the bouncing ball. You know, very simple. And yet that name, I swear to you, gets mispronounced 5, 6, 7, 10 times a day by receptionists, secretaries, cops, doctors, whatever it might be. And it gets turned into these very creative things, you know, like, you know, Mr. Empanada, you know, which is either a meat pie or a cheese pie, depending. So there was a place called Empanadas across the street from the hotel. I thought that was, try to go in there and get a free meal. Yeah. Right, you can sleep on the floor tonight. And I'm, you know, I am waiting for the day that a cop calls me Mr. Desperado. So this is my irrational impulse poem, you know. And if you ever see my blurred color photograph on the front page of USA Today, you'll know how it got there. Poem is called Revolutionary Spanish Lesson. Whenever my name is mispronounced, I want to buy a toy pistol, put on dark sunglasses, push my beret to an angle, comb my beard to a point, hijack a busload of Republican tourists from Wisconsin, force them to chant anti-American slogans in Spanish, and wait for the bilingual SWAT team to helicopter overhead, begging me to be reasonable. Thanks. Yeah, that poem is a joke. I don't mean it literally. Don't come up to me and apologize because you thought my name was pronounced another way. Sometimes people get very nervous. I'm sorry. It's a joke. I didn't mean it, you know. Okay. Again, the power of naming is something I keep coming back to. And this is another poem which has to do with that, I think. There's a phrase in Spanish which I'm going to teach you now, and you should forget it, because if you ever repeat it, you know, you should just have your hands free because you'll need to defend yourself. The phrase is hijo de puta. And that literally, yeah, means son of a whore. Sometimes you'll see it translated as son of a bitch, but it's much, much stronger than that. So now that you know that, forget that you ever heard it. But I was walking around thinking about that phrase one day. I said, hijo de puta. Now, what happens if you are an hijo de puta? And then I met one. And this poem is for him. It's called Portrait of a Real Hijo de Puta. And it's for Michael. Not the obscenity, but a real 10-year-old son of a whore, locked out of the apartment so Mama could return to the slavery of her ancestors, who knew the master's burglary of their bodies at night. Mama, who sleeps in a pool of clear rum. And the real hijo de puta poses with the swim team photograph at the community center, bragging fists in the air, grinning like a cheerleader with hidden cigarette burns, a circus strongman who steals cheese and crackers from the office where the door is deliberately left open. The second half of this book consists of a series of work poems, and I want to read one of those now. This poem is called Jorge the Church Janitor Finally Quits, and again, it's based, as most of the poems are, on an actual person, and yet it's a little different for me because it's written in a persona. It's written in the voice of Jorge, and the reason I chose to do that is because my experiences have been so similar to his, of having a brain and hands, but it's certain jobs being seen only for the hands. So this poem is for him. Jorge the Church Janitor Finally Quits, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1989. No one asks where I am from. I must be from the country of janitors. I have always mopped this floor. Honduras, you are a squatter's camp outside the city of their understanding. No one can speak my name. I host the fiesta of the bathroom, stirring the toilet like a punch bowl. The Spanish music of my name is lost when the guests complain about toilet paper. What they say must be true. I am smart, but I have a bad attitude. No one knows that I quit tonight. Maybe the mop will push on without me, sniffing along the floor like a crazy squid with stringy gray tentacles. They will call it Jorge. Okay. Here's another bathroom poem. That's how I make connections. Sorry. It was mentioned in the introduction that I'm also a lawyer. It is my primary form of amusement. And on one such occasion, working as a lawyer with some bilingual parents in Lynn, Massachusetts, we discovered that in fact, Spanish was banned at lunchtime, which does happen all across the schools of this country. From time to time, you run into it where Spanish is banned at particular times and places. Lunchtime is a popular favorite. So is gym. Of course, gym was always fascist anyway. So I wrote this poem. Well, it was inspired by the principal of that high school, which was called, ironically enough, English High School in Lynn, Massachusetts. So the poem is called The New Bathroom Policy at English High School. The boys chatter Spanish in the bathroom while the principal listens from his stall. The only word he recognizes is his own name, and this constipates him. So he decides to ban Spanish in the bathrooms. Now he can relax. Have you know that poem was on National Public Radio? It's not exactly how you want to be represented if you have one shot, but... this is another short poem. I'll read just two more, and then we'll have our break. We are a migratory people. I refer again to the Puerto Rican community, and yet you might not hear about it because this government keeps better track of its migratory birds than its migratory people. In any case, this is a short poem about an experience traveling through a little town called Cross Plains, Wisconsin. If you ever have the chance to stop there, keep going. Blue bandana across the forehead, beard bristling like a straw broom, sleeveless t-shirt of the Puerto Rican flag with Puerto Rico stamped across the chest, a foreign name on the license, evidence enough for the cop to announce that the choice is cash or jail, that today the fine for speeding is exactly $67, and his car will follow my car out of town. Okay. And I will finish with this poem. I want to thank everybody for coming. Again, it's a terrific turnout. And we're going to have a short intermission. I'll be over there signing books and such, and I just want to remind everybody that there are only 14 shopping days till Christmas. So anyway, I'll end up with this poem. A lot of the work that I do, but also that all Latino writers do, I think, is work of identity and return, of going back. And this next poem has something to do with that and more, I think. It's also about the power of words and the power of kindness. Those two things don't always go together. So I'll finish with this poem. It's called Colibrí, which is the Spanish word for hummingbird. It's based on an experience my wife and I had in the mountains of Puerto Rico a couple of years ago. So she's here tonight, and I dedicate this to her. Again, a couple of Spanish words. I refer to the Taino Indians of Puerto Rico. Plátanos, those are those great big banana-like green things you see in the supermarket. If you cut them up and fry them, they're really sweet. So, Hacienda, of course, the big house. And finally, I make a reference to singing frogs in the poem. That is the coqui of Puerto Rico, which is unique in all the world, a frog that sings at night. So, I'll finish with this, and again, thank you for your attention. Colibrí for Catherine, 1 year later. In Jayuya, the lizards scatter like a fleet of green canoes before the invader. The Spanish conquered with iron and words. Taino for the people who took life from the plátanos in the trees. Those multiple green fingers curling around unseen spears, who left the rock carvings of eyes and mouths in perfect circles of amazement. So the hummingbird was christened Colibrí. Now the Colibrí darts and bangs between the white walls of the hacienda, a racing Taino heart, frantic as if hearing the bellowing god of gunpowder for the first time. The colibrí becomes pure stillness, seized in the paralysis of the prey, when your hands cup the bird and lift him through the red shutters of the window, where he disappears into a paradise of sky, a nightfall of singing frogs. If only history were like your hands. Thank you.